Blog Talk Radio.
My presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in the city. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's T-A-I. LORMADE101.com and click on Blog Talk Radio Affiliate. Once again, it is great to be with you. I'd also like to welcome my co-host to the show, Jima. Now, Jima is the director of training at TaylorMade Training and Consulting and the author of the famous Ask Jima blog. To check out her latest post, go to AskJima.blogspot.com. That's AskJima.blogspot.com. And today we are joined by a very special guest, Leo Baron Hicks. Now, Leo Baron Hicks was born and raised in East St. Louis, a city not without its challenges. He's been married for over 30 years and has two children and two grandchildren. Mr. Hicks received his bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Illinois at Springfield, Illinois, and a law degree from Southern Illinois University School of Law at Carbondale. He has 15 years of experience practicing attorney, but he's the author of the two books, in fact, The New Cotton, and the one we're going to talk about today is The Cotton Chronicles, American Apartheid, Prisons, and the 21st Century Cotton Gin. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you listening via Blog Talk Radio, click the follow button or follow me on Twitter at TaylorMade101.com. But first, let's take a look at our current events. Now, each week I do a segment called Moment of Reflections, and today's Moment of Reflection will be about segregation. Now, this being Black History Month and all, I thought it would be appropriate to take a look back and to see some moments in history where pretty much are taking place today. In particular, Pennsylvania school experiments with segregation. Now, CNN posted an article that talked about a Pennsylvania high school said that some students are separated by race, gender, and language for a few minutes each day in an effort to boost academic scores, raising controversy over the historically contentious issue of segregation in schools. Now, the initiative was a pilot program intended to capitalize on enriching students' experiences through mentoring and was derived from school research that showed grouping Black students together by gender with a strong role model could help boost their academic achievement and self-esteem. Now, according to a statement from McCaskey East High School in Lancaster, educators immediately noticed strong bonds being formed between all students and mentor teachers, the statement said. The junior class at McCaskey East is voluntarily segregated by the students who organize themselves by gender, race, and or language, said school spokesman Kelly Burkholder. But some school experts say that this experiment is misguided. When we talk about reducing the achievement gap, do we mean merely reducing the discrepancy of test scores of white students and students of color, as educating consultant Sam? Or do we mean reducing the predictive impact that things like race, class, and gender have on all aspects of student engagement, performing, and learning. The school's principal defended the policy. One of the things we said when we did this was, let's look at the data. Let's not run from it. Let's confront it and see what we can do about it, said the school's principal. In visiting the classrooms, I saw students planning their path for success after graduation. But while McCaskey East students are segregated for 6 minutes each day and 20 minutes twice a month, some say other school systems in the county appear to be reverting to real segregation. Last month, the NAACP held a 3-day education summit in Raleigh, North Carolina, where the Wake County School Board, boasted by the election of 4 new conservative members last year, ended the school system's 10-year-old diversity policy that used the number of students receiving free or reduced lunches to assist students to school. They plan to replace their policy with neighborhood school system that critics say will establish real segregation. Now, I'm going to reflect on this for a moment. Because it is my position that this quote-unquote segregation is not a bad thing if it's helping the student. I remember many people saying the worst thing that happened to African Americans was desegregation. I've heard many argue that during this time, African American doctors, lawyers, and businessmen were at an all-time high. Moreover, our historically black colleges and universities already practiced this very thing that the administrator was only simply doing for a few moments a day. I heard many people contend that the fall of our school systems were due to the change in who was teaching minorities children just as much as the concerns of what they were being taught. So why is it when an individual tried to institute based on the data that our society goes out and complain or just simply outlash at these administrators? Now, I would love to get your comments on this issue. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Again, the number is 323-580-5712. And when we return, we're going to open up the phone lines and take some calls. I would also solicit the wisdom of my co-host, Jima. Be back in a moment.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Okay, Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. And before we take some calls, I would like to bring Jima on. I'd like to her to weigh in on a few questions. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, Jima, now what's wrong with this situation? If it works, why bother it?
Well, I don't necessarily know if there's anything wrong with it as much as is perception. Some people might feel that separating the students out will lead to other issues happening in the school. But I think for the most part, I was primarily educated in a segregated environment from elementary school anyway. The majority of the students there was people of color such as myself. We were from the same neighborhood. We were able to walk to school. Wasn't too many people on the bus. There were some buses, but it wasn't like we see now where you have kids on buses for 2 and 3 hours trying to get to school. So I'm not real sure. I mean, it works. I mean, like you stated in your opening, you talk about historically black colleges and what has what comes out of those situations. I remember a school in Chicago this past spring that's a charter school, I believe. I can't think of the name of it, but it's an all-male, black male school. I want to say the majority of the teachers are black males as well, and they have 100% graduation rate. And all of those young men that graduated are going to college on 4-year scholarships. So obviously there's some validity to having some sort of excellence when groups of people are grouped together, or it may not have anything to do with that, and it has more to do with the people that are teaching than the actual grouping of the students.
Mm-hmm.
So if we raise the expectations of those that are teaching the students, whether they're all the same or not, therein might be the difference in terms of the turnaround in how kids learn, how they're taught, who's teaching them.
Well, Jima, do you think that our because of our sensitivity to race issues, in particular our race relations within the United States, is always an issue when we try to separate the races, although the data, as he argued, showed that it improved test scores. But because of our sensitivity to race issues, we try to always put, you know, all of these things in a race bucket, and so therefore a disadvantaged bucket. Because, you know, I remember when, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, it talked about separate public schools for black and whites, and that's what the context of the segregation. But in this case, it seems like the institutions were the same and the material was the same. He just thought that the data showed that if you grouped them together, they were more likely to succeed because of the comfort level and the social status that happens within a classroom. What are your thoughts?
Well, and I think though, the part that was left, that people leave off when we're talking about Brown versus the Board of Education, had a lot more to do with the fact that things were separate. They weren't just separate, they were unequal.
Mm-hmm.
So if we fix the thing being unequal and you keep us separate, then the learning of all students will continue to grow. But if you don't fund an area because you've deemed that area to be poverty, a poverty area, so you don't give it the same amount of resources that you give an area that you have not deemed to be a poverty area, therein lies the discrepancy. You can have the best teachers in the world, but if you're not giving them the resources they need to educate those children for not today but for tomorrow, then you're not going to be able to get out of them everything that you can get. They'll do well because the teachers are pushing them to do well, but they would do a lot better if things were equal. So the whole thing around separate was not just it being separate and segregated, but it wasn't equal.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, as you know, Reverend Jackson and Reverend Sharpton and others have often said that when you level the playing field, when all things are up front and we know the rules of the game, we can play.
Mm-hmm.
So when you level the playing field educationally, that means you pay the same per student in an area that might not have as much commercialism as you do in an area that has a lot in it, then you will get the same, you will get better results because the resources are being provided.
So, Jimmy, that sounds like then the problem stems from how we fund our education. And what I mean by that is the simple fact that when you look at communities that are doing really well, that are receiving the resources that they, that's required to have a quality education, is based on the tax structure or the income levels of that community. And so if the tax structure is so that they're going to be getting a certain percentage of taxes, which feeds into that education system, then quite naturally people that are wealthy, people that are making moderate incomes, are going to be feeding into that system, so they're going to be able to get resources. You know, on the other hand, when you have a neighborhood that do not have those tax dollars feeding into the system, they do not have that wealth, they're not able to contribute into the tax bucket for that education, they're not going to be able to get the quality of resources into that school system. So it sounds like to me then, if we're talking about unequal, we're talking about the resources that's required to fully educate a child, then it seems to me that we need to be looking at how we fund those systems. Your thoughts?
Well, it's twofold. I mean, it's not the problem is that the, everything we're talking about is symptoms of what's really going on. The big issue is that we're no longer educating our students to learn. We're teaching them to take a test.
Okay.
When we've got away from educating our students to learn something new, and we built up on that every year. Everything you learned in the second grade, you built up on that in the third grade and in the fourth grade. We don't do that anymore. It's all about know this for this year, because next year you're going to learn something totally different. So, yeah, we can put more money out there, but if we're not putting more money in the system to educate children to learn and teach them how to learn, we're not teaching them how to learn, we're not teaching them how to think, and yet we wonder why they're not progressing in such a manner that we feel they should be when they reach a certain age. Well, we haven't taught them how to do that. So when you're not learning how to problem solve in math and then learning how to read and comprehend, there's no reason. It shouldn't be a surprise that when it comes time to do some deductive reasoning for yourself about whether you should go do this with this group of people or not, you haven't been taught the skills to make that kind of decision. So we stopped educating our children. We stopped teaching them how to learn. Therein is the core of the problem. Everything else we're dealing with is the fallout and the symptom. The core is we stopped teaching.
Well, Jima, you know, I hear you, and I understand what you're saying. However, I want to challenge something that you said about the test. Right. If we are truly teaching our children and you're talking about deductive reasoning, being able to think, well, how are we going to measure that? If you don't have these text structures and if you don't have a way to make an honest assessment of a person's learning ability, then I'm not going to say just throw out the test. I think you, if you're teaching to the test, you're teaching somewhat that the fundamentals of problem solving. I mean, you know, when you're talking about this test structure, you know, they have these quiz, they have these math equations, they have these essay equations, they ask you, you know, something about rote memorization, but yet and still, it's a way to measure a person's progress.
I have no problem with testing. It's not as though I didn't take tests growing up, because we did. We took tests every Friday, it seemed like, at some point in my life. So the testing is not what I'm concerned about. And there's more than one way to measure what a person has learned without it just being on a test. But from what I understand, the test that kids are getting nowadays, these graduation exams that you have to take in order to graduate, and you've been in school your whole life, and it's this one thing that's going to make a determination whether or not you know enough to graduate. I don't necessarily know if that makes sense. I don't necessarily know if that's fair. I don't necessarily know if that's logical. To put it all on that thing, that one thing that we've been, you know, testing to, and that's all you hear. I don't hear people say, you know, go home and practice your reading or practice your writing or practice your math or practice your science. I hear teachers say, if we get another week off from school, you guys better be getting ready for the tax test.
Well, I mean, but if we look at how people enter college is through a test. How people are measured on where they're placed for, post-secondary education is based on a test. People do prepare themselves, and it is a measure of how well you know something by those tests. So it's almost like the teachers have a goal, an end goal in mind, and it's all a common goal. So let's say, for example, in the East Texas, they have, you know, they're teaching certain knowledge, you know, based on, you know, what's localized to that area. But in West Texas, they were teaching to some other type of localized information. But the way the test structure is now, everybody is pretty much learning the same thing. And it's really to build the foundation so they can move on. So I kind of tend to agree with how the tests were introduced into the system under the No Child Left Behind Act by President George Bush, that the fact that he said, let's measure what our kids are learning, and let's do that in a nationalized way. Your thoughts?
Okay, but in doing that, though, and that's fine in theory, but in practice, since we've enacted this particular way of teaching, where have we fallen globally in those areas of math, of science, of reading comprehension, based on how where we were prior to this whole testing thing and where we are now? So obviously there's some disconnect, because we're not performing globally where we were prior to making some of these changes. Now, I'm not saying that there should not be tests. Everybody has a test. There has to be a way to, like you say, measure what you know and what you don't know, so we'll know where to intervene at. I get that. I'm just saying I don't know if how we're teaching, and I'm not a teacher, so I love teachers. I'm not saying that it's all teachers. It appears to me that there's a direct correlation. Between how things have shifted in terms of how our kids are learning and what they know.
Okay. I think that's a fair assessment of the situation we're in right now. I mean, you talked about the test scores not being that well. They're measured so many years from now. And so, you know, if we take a look back over the fact that, you know, over the last 8 years or so, maybe shorter than that, that we've instituted the test, the metrics, the data shows that it has not improved how we're teaching our kids. So I definitely agree with you on that. So I would love to get our special guest to weigh in on the situation. And so up next, we're going to bring on Leo Baron Hicks. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Leo Baron Hicks was born and raised in East St. Louis. He's an attorney. He's been practicing for about 15 years, and he's the author of two books. And the one we're going to talk about today is called The Cotton Chronicles, American Apartheid, Prisons, and the 21st Century Cotton Gins. And when we return, we're going to bring on Leo Baron Hicks. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Okay, welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Up next, we're going to be talking to Leo Baron Hicks. Leo, are you there?
I am. How you doing, Mr. Cook?
Oh, absolutely wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Now, I want you to tell me a little bit about your book, The Cotton Crumbs. Give me a little background on the book.
Well, for 15 years, I practiced law mainly in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Madison, Wisconsin, and I did a great deal of criminal law. And my experiences practicing law and dealing with the criminal justice system and actually dealing with us, African Americans, and other minorities as defendants in the criminal justice system led me to some conclusions. And basically that's what the genesis for the New Cotton and the Cotton Chronicles is.
Interesting. Now, I've been reading your book, and I have to tell you, it is amazing.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate that.
You know, I want to read an excerpt, and I want to read several of them, but I wanted to read the one that's entitled Lady Justice, the Beast. I think this is really, really profound. And so bear with me as I try to do this some justice, because this is an amazing read, and I want to get you to respond. It says, she sits on a pedestal, inert. In one hand, she holds the scales of justice, perfectly balanced. In the other hand, she grasps a sword, broad, swift, and terrible. Her skin is marble, cool to the touch. Her long metallic tunic is elegant and graceful, creating an air of class and sophistication. A blindfold covers her eyes, signifying the concept that justice is blind. However, Lady Justice is far from sightless. For beneath the sterile blindfold, her eyes are wide open. Her X-ray vision is 20/20. Her senses are hyper-acute, enabling her to hear, smell, and sense her prey, no matter the distance. Worse, she leaves nothing to chance. Her plan of attack is deliberate, orchestrated, and coordinated. Her actions are practiced and perfected. Her determination is like tempered steel, and her focus alone is sharp enough to draw blood. She has one objective and one objective only, to feed, to feast, and her appetite is insatiable. This is the benign face of the beast, a wolf in sheep's clothing, part lupine, part feline, all reptile. Her maw is lined with row upon row of fangs, all dripping of venom. With nostrils flaring, her head swivels from side to side, anchored by a massive neck and shoulders, muscles rippled and flexed with every move she makes, devouring prey in one bite. With an orifice powerful enough to crush bedrock, she prowls concrete jungles for quarries so conditioned by its environment, so blind to its plight as to be completely unaware that it is being stalked. Quarries so lost that it almost begs to be consumed, prey so directionless that it literally runs towards rather than away from danger. The beast is a ravenous creature that consumes everything in its path. an eating machine that does not eat to live, but lives to eat. More troubling, she has developed a fondness of dark meat. Wow.
Wow, yeah. Indeed.
Wow.
So, wow.
So it's so much in this. So give me a little background on how you came up with this and what drove you to write this particular passage.
Okay, well, you know, the concept that the people who support and endorse the criminal justice system is that America has the best system, legal system in the world, and justice is blind, and justice is meted out fairly, irregardless as to your economic or social status. My experiences taught me that that is a lie, that justice is far from blind. Justice sees very well, and it knows exactly what it's doing, and it picks out the people that it wants to chew up. The thing about the prey so completely unaware of what's going on that it literally runs towards danger instead of away from danger is us, African Americans. In my experience, man, I represented clients who did some of the most god-awful things that you could imagine. I mean, I had one client, for example, who sexually assaulted his nephew. I mean, he didn't have any place to live. He lived with his sister. And this is a grown man, Mr. Cook, like you and I, and he literally sexually assaulted his own nephew. African-Americans who would beat up and dog out other African-Americans and have no inkling of how wrong that was, how morally wrong that was, and what they did in terms of devastating our own community. And lastly, I called it Lady Justice the Beast because the criminal justice system is a monster. It is worse than the Frankenstein monster. It reminds me of a cross between aliens, I'm sure you've seen the movie Aliens, and a werewolf. It is just ravenous beyond all comprehension.
Now, so why is it that, in your opinion, that there are more African Americans in the system? Because I gathered from the last statement there about dark meat that you were referring to the African American. A more troubling has developed a fondness of dark meat.
Absolutely. There are two reasons that African Americans predominate on the bad end, the criminal justice system. First, because the criminal justice system is not about justice. It is about power and economics and social and political control. At the end of the Civil War, with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, forces in this country were looking for another way to get what they had, i.e. free labor. And they were looking for another way to enslave African Americans. Well, they couldn't do it based on the color of their skin, our skin. So they hit upon the idea of the 13th Amendment, which says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States or any place subject to its jurisdiction, but upon conviction of a crime, punishment or conviction of a crime. So that phrase, but upon punishment or conviction of a crime, was intentionally put in the 13th Amendment as a way to re-enslave African Americans. And it has done a marvelous job of doing that.
Go ahead.
And the second reason we predominate the criminal justice system is because of our own conduct. And basically that is conduct dogging each other out. 94% of the homicides in this country of black people are committed by other black people. That means if you stand up 10 black people and their fate, unfortunately, is to die violently, 9.5 of those 10 black people will be killed by another black person. That's an amazing statistic.
Wow. It is staggering. So you mentioned the fact that the two reasons, one being cheap labor, the other being our own condition, our own conduct. in your opinion, do you think that anything can be done about that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, one thing to do is for us to stop looking to others to solve our problems. Convincing the criminal justice system to dispense justice is like trying to convince an alligator to give up meat.
Okay.
It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Alligators are carnivores. They're not herbivores. They are not going to give up meat. And the same thing applies to the criminal justice system. So we have to change, not the criminal justice system. We have to change. And the best thing that we can do is to stop dogging each other out.
Interesting. Now, you also talk about your book, and I kind of took subtitles out of your book and kind of made them my own, basically. But in this part, you talked a little bit about affirmative action and reverse discrimination. I'm going to read a portion of it here that was in what we call the art of intentional forgetfulness and willful ignorance. And I want to mention two things here. One, I want to talk about the fact that you talked about the art of intentional forgetfulness. And it says here that America has made significant strides in race relations. Gone are the days of lynching parties, white race riots, and church bombings. Jim Crow is dead. The separate but equal doctrine has expired, and white-only drinking fountains are a thing of the past. Nevertheless, America's racial history remains a painful chapter in our legacy. There can be no mistake as to which nation, economic system, or form of government developed the Let's Make a Slave treaties. The atrocities of the peculiar institution, the repressive slave syndrome, Jim Crow, and the separate but equal doctrine were not the brain children of Edgefield France, communist Russia, or socialist Sweden. There are many shortcomings notwithstanding. The domestic terrorism and the ethnic cleansing of black lynching and white race riots were neither created nor practiced by the Hindus, Buddhists, Wiccans, or pagans. These atrocities were committed in America, fathered and nurtured by the economic system known as capitalism. The participants were, for the most part, Christians, the same Christians who went to church every Sunday after hanging and castrating helpless black men every Friday, who loved their God while despising their darker-skinned brothers, and who studied their Bibles with the same hands and hearts with their white robes. Now, and so I want to bring this out because over the past couple of months, there have been, seems to me, a campaign to change our history. I remember some legislation in Texas talking about removing some language out of the textbooks. One of the classics were talking about removing the N-word out of Istex. So it seems like to me that you were far ahead of your time when you wrote this book, but it seems like to me that we're moving in a direction where we're trying to rewrite history. What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. The rewriting of history, the repositioning of history, is crucial in terms of social control and political power. What you're talking about in terms of removing the N-word occurred because somebody didn't like the word nigger and mm-hmm. decided to remove it from Mark Twain's, Huckleberry Finn, I believe it
mm-hmm.
is. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, I mean, it's not a good word. Clearly, it's not a good word. But you can't whitewash history, because when you do that, what you do is produce people just like Sarah Palin. Don't know nothing, but convinced she's right. And so you're able to condition people, and you're able to wash away the horrors of slavery. And that has tremendous political and economic power when you do that. With the white race riots that occurred between about 1870 and about 1965, as soon as the white race riots occurred, the white people who committed those race riots refused to talk about it.
Huh.
You know, it's like it never happened. That's intentional forgetfulness. And the willful ignorance comes on our part when we choose not to know our own history. If you ask most young people today about African American history, the furthest they can go back is Martin Luther King. And they don't know much about that. And so they don't understand and appreciate the tremendous sacrifices that were made to put them in a position where they could excel.
Uh-huh.
And that's the problem. That's the point I'm making in terms of willful ignorance.
Wow. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, number is 323-580-5712. And today our very special guest is Leo Baron Hicks. He's the author of several books, or at least a couple of books that I know about, but the one we're talking about today is The Cotton Chronicles, American Apartheid, Prisons, and the 21st Century Cotton Gin. So explain the component about the American apartheid in your book.
American apartheid basically is what happened to African Americans after the Civil War. Jim Crow, a legal caste system that relegated African Americans to an inferior position economically, socially, and politically. It is no different from what happened in Africa in terms of the system of apartheid, where coloreds and blacks had no political rights, had no economic rights, had no social rights. In fact, apartheid, quite frankly, is the stepchild of what happened in America in terms of Jim Crow. Jim Crow is very interesting because the term Jim Crow comes from this white actor who was really down on his luck. I mean, he was a white actor. He wasn't making a lot of money. And one day he saw this little black boy walk past, and he was singing a song called Jim Crow. And so the white actor had a brainstorm. So that night he put on blackface, and he went on stage, and he mocked what he saw. He portrayed African Americans in the worst possible light as dumb, uneducated, shiftless, lazy niggas. And he was a hit. They loved him. And so then after that, other white actors did the same thing. They would put on blackface, and they would shuck and jive and just appeal to the worst stereotypes of black people. And they were hits, too. They made a lot of money. Interestingly enough, black actors did the same thing. They started putting on blackface, and they went to the minstrel shows, and they portrayed African Americans in the worst possible light. And the thing about willful ignorance is this: you see rap videos basically do the same thing, right?
Right.
You've got some animal black man, half naked. You got half-naked black women shaking and making it clap. I mean, just basically sexual whores, just sexual animals.
Mm-hmm.
You got a phallic symbol because somebody's got a gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're uneducated. They got bling on, et cetera, et cetera. And if we just knew our history, if we just knew the relationship between the minstrel shows and what we see on some of the rap videos, perhaps we wouldn't demean ourselves for a few coins like we do.
Wow. Now, you also mentioned in your book that says, I'm reading another excerpt here, it says, complaining about reverse discrimination is another often used example of cognitive dissonance. Linda Chavez, former staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights under the Reagan administration and prominent conservative commentator, opines that affirmative action has mutated into a quota system that harms minorities in need by lowering standards, radicalizing students, and permitting students to remain in school despite failing grades. You go on to say, according to Ms. Chavez, in the 40 years that affirmative action programs have operated, millions of deserving white and Asian students have been passed over at competitive schools in order to admit blacks and Hispanics with significantly lower standardized admission scores in high school grades. It is telling that Ms. Chavez concentrates on the 40 or so years of affirmative action that arguably benefits blacks. while ignoring 6 centuries of affirmative action that exclusively benefited whites. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, the notion that affirmative action has resulted in the wholesale disenfranchisement of white people is absurd. Take this test. Go to any urban city in America and see who comes out of those office buildings at 12 and 5 o'clock. You don't see many brothers coming up out of that. Yeah? You don't see many sisters coming up out of that. The shameful truth is white females really usurped affirmative action. With Title X in terms of sports, they're the ones who really benefit from affirmative action. There is an affirmative action program, but that program exists in the criminal justice system. That's where the real quota exists, not in academia and not in the corporate offices of America.
Wow. Now, you talked a little bit about the prison systems. You explained American apartheid. Talk a little bit about the 21st century cotton gin.
War on drugs, baby. That's all it is. During the time of the original slavery, slavery almost died out. You know, because it took a lot of labor to go ahead and separate the cotton from the seeds. You know, if you ever seen cotton grow, they grow in these big tufts. And
right.
You've literally got to pick the cotton out and separate it from the husk and the seed. Well, slavery almost died out until Eli Whitney came forward with his cotton gin, a machine that did the work of separating the cotton from the husk and the seeds. And then that gave a big shot in the arm to slavery. Well, the same thing happened with the war on drugs. The war on drugs has been instrumental in funneling African Americans from the streets of America to the prison system. Many people think that most African Americans take drugs. That's not true. The biggest user of drugs in this country are white people, not black people. And if you really want to stomp out drug use, put narcs in American colleges instead of in the inner city. Every American college you can think of, all of the students are smoking, drinking, doing multiple drugs from Thursday through Tuesday. But they dare not do that, because if they do that, that means that some of these white kids are going to be swept up in these drug raids, and they're going to prison, and the dominant society is not going to have it.
Wow. In your book, you write, in October 1982, in a weekly radio address, President Ronald Reagan declared the opening salvo in the war on drugs, using military terms like battle, war, and surrender. Reagan launched a public relations campaign to change the public perception of drug use and the threat posed by illegal drugs by demonizing drugs, ostracizing drug users. Reagan and every other president since then have fought the war on two fronts. First, it is a supply reduction strategy, which is designed to reduce the availability of drugs by limiting access to drug sources and to increase the risk of drug possession and usage. Second, is a demand reduction in front, which seeks to reduce demand through drug use prevention and treatment. Since its inception, the drug war has primarily relied on the interdiction, seizure, and criminal prosecution of the supply reduction strategy. So, to your point is that we were focusing on the users as opposed to the suppliers.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And again, in terms of willful ignorance, because I just think that point is crucial. We as a people must know our history. It's important because history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. Everything that's going on now happened before. It was just a different name. First, you had the slave codes, you know, which was a set of rules that slaves had to obey, else they would be killed. That mutated into the black codes after the Civil War, another set of rules that blacks had to obey or suffer the consequences. Today, you have things like driving while black. You have, you know, what is it like when they go to the airport, ethnic profiling?
Mm-hmm. Racial profiling,
Yeah, racial profiling, thank you. It's basically the same thing. It's just a different name. And if you will look at how drugs have been used by the conquering society, it has always been used against the people that were intended to be conquered. It happened in terms of the Revolutionary War when this country was first founded. The settlers gave Indians what? Alcohol, because they had a very low tolerance for it, and then they became alcoholics, and so they couldn't resist the taking over of their land. It is rumored that Andrew Jackson intentionally gave Native Americans blankets infected with smallpox to kill them all. If you will look at the war in Indochina, the Vietnam War, that was really started in large part because the French had a monopoly on the drug trade there. And if you look at the crack epidemic in this country, it is rumored that Ronald Reagan, in an attempt to fund the Contras, you know, the war in Nicaragua, they didn't have the Contras didn't have money to buy weapons that we were selling them to fight the war. So someone came up with a brilliant idea of let the Contras introduce crack cocaine in America. They recruited black people, the Bloods and the Crips, to sell that crack cocaine. And with the money they got from the sale of crack cocaine, they bought arms for America by which to engage in that war. And again, this is history. And the problem I have is we know who some rapper is sleeping with. We know the latest model of a telephone. We know spinners, but we don't know our own history.
Wow. So I have one, I guess, deeper question. So if it is true that, they consider themselves to be a superior race, if it is true they have all the wealth, if it is true that they are more knowledgeable in a lot of different cases because of what you see in history, then why is it then that they would try to target a lesser people? Why is it then that they would use these tactics that you talk about, drugs, things of that nature, to keep a race of people down when they are already, quote-unquote, superior?
Well, first of all, I don't think that white people think that they're the superior race, okay? Secondly, because you can't paint everybody with that broad a brush. There are great Caucasians here. The Caucasians were instrumental in forming the NAACP. The Caucasians were instrumental in ending slavery. Caucasians were instrumental in the Underground Railroad. So I don't want to come off as a racist because I'm really not. It's not about race. It is about socioeconomics. It is about money, and it always has been about money. If you know your history, for example, you know that groups mistreat other groups irregardless of their race. There are black people who mistreat black people. There are white people who have mistreated white people. There are Catholics who have mistreated other Christians. It's about socioeconomics. It's about money. Always has been, always will be.
But where's the advantage that one gains then economically if, you know, to do all of these things in African America? What I don't see the correlation between how African Americans are being treated in the United States and a rationale for doing it.
Money. I mean, look, again, people who are about money will exploit the least powerful, the least organized. If a particular group happens to be the least politically power and the least organized, then that group will be exploited. Originally, when the Europeans came to this country, they tried to enslave white people first, but that didn't work for any number of reasons. Then they tried to enslave Native Americans. That didn't work either for a number of reasons. First of all, because America was a Native Americans' land, And so once they ran away from the plantation, they blended into the territory could never be found again. And also because Native Americans were susceptible to European diseases like smallpox and diphtheria and typhoid fever and all. And so when the Europeans got over here first, scores of Native Americans died from European diseases. Black people were enslaved not so much because of the color of their skin, but because it was easier to enslave them. We were more resistant to European diseases. This was not our home. We had different languages. And the color of our skin made it easy to discriminate black people because you could separate black people from white people based purely on the color of your skin. So race was a factor. But believe me, if they could have enslaved Irish people, they would have.
So basically, it's not about race. And so for many people to keep pushing or playing the race card, they need to be really looking toward the economics of the situation, not the race of the situation.
Absolutely. It is about socioeconomics in every sense of the word. It is about owning your own business, owning your own house. It is about education. You believe in education. I know you're a very intelligent man. In some African-American communities, you know what the high school graduation rate is, Mr. Cook?
What is it?
30%.
Wow.
30%. No group of people can long survive if only 30% of their kids are graduating from high school. It is about taking care of your family. You know, I'm married, you're married. We both know that marriage ain't easy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
But there's something more important than just you and how you feel, and that is taking care of your family.
Mm-hmm.
And real men, I don't care what color they are, they take care of their family. So if they have to get their butts kicked going to work and being dogged out by people who don't appreciate them, they do it because it is their responsibility to do it. And until we adopt those positive values and attitudes, until we enhance our own skills, then this is going to be a problem, period.
Wow. You have been an amazing guest today. I really appreciate you joining. For those of you listening, you're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Today's very special guest is Leo Baron Hicks. He's the author of The Cotton Chronicles, American Apartheid, Prisons, and 21st Century Cotton Gin. Go out to my blog. The link is out there to go buy his book. I'm telling you, go out there. You're going to learn a whole lot of information. Go out there and get the book today. Again, that's TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. The book is out there. The link, go get the book today. Again, that's TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. Go out there and get the book. Leo, any final thoughts?
Yeah, you can also get the books from my website, www.thenewcotton.com, where they can get the Cotton Chronicles and they can get the first book, The New Cotton, From Race Chattel Slavery to Race Conviction Slavery. And in terms of self-promotion, I'm almost through with the third book, which is called The Fourth Holocaust. And it is a projection, a very gloomy projection, I might add,
mm-hmm.
of where African-Americans may be if the trend lines continue.
Wow. Again, give the web address to where they can get the book.
www.thenewcotton.com. And you can also get my clothing line, too, from that website. So, again, that's www.thenewcotton.com.
Outstanding. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, a show designed to engage, empower, and educate listeners with the right information at the right time to make the right decisions. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, where we showcase small businesses, churches, entrepreneurs, and nonprofits. Remember to join us next week, Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time. And this month, we're going to be showcasing all African-American authors in celebration of Black History Month. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to current events with Patrick Cook.